Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. The emergency department is known for its management and stabilization of critical patients, but the transition to inpatient hospital care and later discharge are equally critical for the functioning of this system. Hospitalists and emergency department physicians collaborate to provide 24-hour care to patients in emergency situations. Joining us today is Dr. Daniel Minlin, a board-certified emergency medicine physician and chair of emergency medicine at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Also joining us is Dr. Robert Finch, a board-certified family medicine physician and hospitalist with the Alaska Hospitalist Group, caring for patients admitted at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Dr. Minlin, Dr. Finch, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Good morning. Thank you. And you can also join our conversation. Do you have a question about emergency care at Alaska's hospitals? Are you curious about the challenges that doctors in the emergency department face? Do you have a question about how hospitalists work and who they care for? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So before we get into the depths of emergency care and hospitalist care, I want to learn more about each of you and how you got into your respective fields. So let's start with Dr. Minlin. Did you enter medical school knowing that you wanted to become an emergency department physician?
I did. At least I had an inkling. Before I delve into that, I'm going to offer my twin disclaimers, the first of which is the really important one, which is that I'm not here on behalf of Providence and not representing Providence and purely offering my own opinions. And the second of which is just that I am originally from Brooklyn, New York, and I tend to talk fast. And so everybody will have to just give me a hand wave to slow down if I take off. But to answer your question, I did. I entered med school with the idea that that was probably what I wanted to do. As I said, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I actually used to be able to see the Twin Towers from my brother's bedroom. And when 9/11 happened, I was not in New York. I was away for a semester, and I had this very odd feeling of being separated from the city, of having sort of not been there for this big thing. And missing out is not the word, of course, but of just sort of not sharing in this thing that had affected the city. And it was a huge part of my identity being from New York. And I felt like I needed to do something to kind of dive back in somehow and reconnect. And I ended up taking a year off after high school and working as an EMT. And did that for a year and then went to college, and fairly early in college made the decision to go to med school, with the sort of recognition that that really felt like it had been a good fit for me, but I wanted to see what happened, you know, after I dropped patients off. And that ended up being, you know, I kept my mind open and considered other things and really kept coming back to this idea of working in the emergency department, and seems like I was right. So far, so good.
Yes. So I like that you're from Brooklyn. You're a fast talker. So you like the fast pace of the emergency department.
That's it.
Yeah. But I could also understand you being away from New York. That was certainly a time at 9/11 that brought the city together. And so I could see that there would be a sense of loss not being there, I guess, to support each other. But you were away for just a semester. Were you doing rotation in med school?
I was actually still in high school at the time.
Oh, in high school.
I was a junior in high school, and I was doing this program called the Maine Coast Semester. And I was spending, I was up in Wiscasset, Maine, up on the Maine Coast, learning to recognize bird calls and researching the lobster industry. So it was a very odd time to be doing that.
A man with many talents. Well, what brought you to Alaska?
Followed a girl. my wife's a pediatrician, and we actually met after the match. So after we had both matched for residency, we met on a wilderness medicine elective a week after match day. And so she was in the first graduating class from the Seattle Children's Alaska track. So she spent a year of her residency up here, 4 months every year for 3 years, two months in Anchorage, 2 months in Bethel every year. And I came up to visit, and I actually proposed in Bethel. And she sort of kept mentioning, like, you know, I'd really like to spend some time up here. I'd really think about living here. My whole family is in Brooklyn. I did residency in Los Angeles. I was not seriously considering moving to Alaska. And we sort of reached this point after, you know, me saying over and over, like, nah, I'm not moving to Alaska. We finally reached this point of saying, you know what, like, we'll try it out and we'll see how it goes. And we'll give it, you know, 5 years or so. And 7 years later, coming up on 7 years, we're not going anywhere. Both our kids were born here, and it's just such an incredible place to have kids and such an incredible place to live. And it feels like a privilege to be here. And it's a really special place to practice medicine. So she was right and I was wrong.
It always starts with a year. You're going to stay here in Alaska for a year, and then it's 5 years, and then it's a lifetime. That's just how it happens. Well, I practiced in New York as well. And I kind of feel, and I think we all have that New York connection. And I thought if you practice in New York, you can practice anywhere. You see everything. And I thought that until I came here to Alaska. And this is the first place where I felt, wow, this is different. This is definitely a challenge. And the things that I see here are just very different than what I've seen in the lower 48. Have you found that to be true?
I have. I mean, there are commonalities, right? I mean, humans are to some extent the same everywhere. Fewer bear maulings in New York, fewer bear maulings in L.A. too.
Yes.
You know, I think, and, you know, having trained in L.A. too, some of the stuff in L.A. that was really a downer, right? Really, I mean, the level of violence in, and, you know, it's not a knock on L.A. specifically. It's just a big city with a lot of people close together. And but the certainly that has been a change for the better to sort of not be exposed to that level of violence and loss of life every day. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, you know, Alaskans are tough in a way that people outside Alaska aren't always. It's just different. And you see people really bear up with some really challenging situations in ways that never cease to amaze me. And also sometimes people who maybe should have come into the hospital, well, you know, a month earlier or 6 hours earlier or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And the distance that people live away from hospitals is certainly challenging.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Finch, let's learn about you. But before we actually learn about you, I think you need to educate us about what a hospitalist is.
Definitely. So basically, a hospitalist is a physician that takes care of admitted patients in the hospital. When people come to the emergency room, they often can get their acute issues dealt with and stabilized and even discharged from the emergency department. But sometimes that can't happen. And when that can't happen, the hospitalists are usually called by my colleagues, the emergency room physicians, and then we come down and to the emergency room, or if they've already been admitted and got up to the floor, we come and see them and take care of them while they're in the hospital. And there can be a wide range of different illnesses and conditions that we treat in the hospital, ranging from congestive heart failure exacerbations, asthma exacerbations, COPD exacerbations, different types of infections, skin infections, abdominal infections, pneumonias, brain infections. It can get very hairy at times, depending on what we're treating. The common question I get is, where do you work in the hospital? And I tell people, everywhere, literally everywhere. We go, you know, from the ICU at times to the step-down units to the PCUs to the ortho floors, the med-surg floors. We even go into the behavioral health unit and do consults there. I've been in mother-baby unit to do consults there. So literally, I work everywhere in the hospital. Wherever a patient needs us and needs treated in the hospital, that's where we take care of them.
We're there. Well, when I was in medical school and we would shadow primary care physicians, we would go to the hospital before their office hours and then again after their office hours to round on all of the patients they had there. And so this has really changed. When did this change occur? Have there always been hospitalists? Were there hospitalists at that time?
No, there hasn't always been hospitalists. That would be more of what you referred to as more of a traditional medicine where, you would get up early and you round on the people that were admitted to the hospital under your care that were normally your patients as an outpatient in your office. And then you'd go back to your office and you do your whole day of office and answer calls from the hospital. And then when you're done with your day, you'd go back to the hospital and round on them again and make sure everything, you know, was buttoned up for the night and maybe take calls in the night. And you can you can see how that would be very exhausting. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know exactly when it happened, but there was a time where some physicians were like, you know, I really like office medicine, and other physicians were like, I really like the hospital medicine. And deals were struck, and basically when you see your outpatient physician, he takes care of you, or he or she takes care of you as an outpatient, and when they when you come to the hospital and need to be admitted, you're usually taken care of by a hospitalist. It's very rare right now for traditional medicine to still be in the community. There's, I think, only two physicians in our community right now that still practice that way. And kudos to them. It's wow. A very hard job. So,
wow. And then maybe we should talk about OB hospitalists or laborists and the difference there.
So we don't have any of those in our group, but yes, that is an even newer thing where instead of OBGYNs, you know, coming in all hours of the night and working and delivering babies, and there are actual OBs that are in the hospital, and they kind of take whatever comes in that isn't assigned to a outpatient OBGYN.
Yes, excellent. Well, let's hear about you. How did you get on this path? How did you become first family practice physician and then hospitalist?
So in med school, in my clinicals, I really enjoyed delivering babies and being in the OB world, actually. And so I started doing all my clinicals to pursue a career in OBGYN. And towards the end of my med school, I did one rotation with some OBs that had been practicing for 20 plus years, and saw them putting immense amount of hours in, even when they had a large call group and they were always working. And I said to myself, you know, I don't see myself putting that many hours in. I want to be, you know, a present husband, present father for my kids. And I didn't see that they were doing that well. And so that changed my mind of, well, what could I still deliver babies? But I wouldn't have to if I didn't need to. And that's family medicine, where you can, you know, that's the only two real paths that deliver babies in medicine. And so I got into a residency in South Jersey. That was a family medicine residency, and it was a very small residency, so we spent a lot of time in the hospital. And I realized, although I like delivering babies, which I do still, I don't deliver babies anymore, but I still enjoyed that part of my life. I did enjoy working in the hospital a lot more, and the complexity of it. And I think it's a little bit like with the ER physicians, you know, there's the ability to find the answer quickly and delve into that. Where as an outpatient, you know, patient comes in, you have to, okay, well, I think this is going on, but maybe I need some labs, maybe I need some studies. And a week later, they might be able to get in to get their study or their labs. And it's not as quick as you would want it. Where in the hospital, I can order the test, you know, stat, it has to be done within an hour. I get the answer and then treat them. And I also feel like, obviously, being in the hospital, you have sicker patients and more challenging cases. So, and I became a hospitalist.
So you like getting answers fast. I can see that. Like, if you order a test, yes, it'd be great for them to have it right away. Yeah. So you get to solve your mystery.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Not always.
So did you ever work in outpatient medicine, or did you go straight from your training to being a hospitalist?
Straight from residency to being a hospitalist. I got done with my residency in Jersey, South Jersey, June 30th, 2015, and I was back up here July 1st, 2015. So, like, it'd take me a day to get back up here, and I started in August 1st.
You grew up here?
Since I was in eighth grade, yeah. I grew up in Fairbanks, North Pole area. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I was coming home.
Yes, coming home. And this is it, then.
Yeah. I don't plan on moving.
What specialties do hospitalists come from? Are they generally family practice or?
Internal medicine and family practice. Medicine. Yeah, those are the two that kind of streamline into the hospitalist work. So,
do you collaborate with outpatient physicians while you have patients admitted? So if someone has an outpatient primary care doctor, is there any collaboration during their visit?
Sometimes. Not probably as much as we should, to be quite honest. Days get away from us, and we should probably call maybe a little bit more. But a lot of times there are good histories. Some of the patients have been admitted many times, so they're already known to us. But when we do have questions, we definitely reach out. And especially if there's like a complex case, a complex discharge, a lot of things happen in the hospital. A lot of times I'll reach out to their primary care provider and be like, hey, this is what went on during the hospitalization. Because not all, I mean, as much things we can put in the notes is great, but there's always the nuances that don't make it into the notes that help provide better continuity of care.
Right. So then when they're discharged and they go back to their primary care, mm-hmm. they'll know where to pick up.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Do you have the need to communicate with other specialists while patients are admitted?
All the time. Mm-hmm. All the time. In fact, I just got off 2 weeks. Our group has a specific doctor that works with the trauma surgeon, so we can collaborate for the medical needs of the patients that have went through traumas. And so we have a daily meeting with the trauma surgeons on mm-hmm. that group. But we meet with infectious disease doctors, cardiologists, GI doctors all the time and talk with them on the phone. I have so many names in my phone right now. we talk with them all the time.
You have a very valuable phone.
Yes, a very valuable phone.
Well, how do you determine who needs a specialty consult while they're there in the hospital versus who can follow up with a specialist as an outpatient?
Experience, I guess. You know, when you first come into hospital medicine, you might be a little more nervous and consult people a little bit more. But as you get more experience under your belt and know what the specialists have done in the past, sometimes you can say, well, I can manage this, you know, a little bit longer. But also, I feel like if you do that too long, you might get yourself into a little bit of trouble, and then you call the specialist and they kind of look at you like, you should have called me a couple days ago type of situation. But there's no real right or wrong way to know. A lot of times it's just having that open communication with the specialist, talking with them, even if it's what we call a sidebar, where you mm-hmm. kind of, hey, I got this patient that is yada, yada, yada. And they say, well, I think they could follow up with me as an outpatient, and then we get that arranged. So
you're getting input when needed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it would be interesting to hear about some of the common medical emergencies that come into the emergency department and to the inpatient floors.
Yeah, we it's funny because we always joke that, you know, today was a chest pain day, today was a belly pain day. And it's really, you know, it is true to some extent. But I mean, absolutely, chest pain is a huge part of what we see, because it turns out there's a lot of important stuff in there. And it turns out that people are aware of that. So you have chest pain, there's a good chance you'll be coming into the emergency department. And, you know, some of our approach to that is algorithmic and saying, okay, you come in, you're this age, you have these risk factors. Now we need to get a troponin, which is the test to, you know, one of the tests to help determine if you're having a heart attack. Okay, we do or don't need to get a second troponin in a couple of hours. And that's probably the number one sort of thing that we see. Certainly a lot of abdominal pain. You know, a fair number of worried well. And, you know, it depends. You know, we see all comers, right? So we see adults, we see children, we see younger adults, older adults. And so if you're working a shift in our pediatric ER, you might see, you know, half your patients in the height of winter have viral respiratory illnesses, and the vast majority of those kids are going to go home. But you need to be able to recognize the ones that are going to need some respiratory support, or just need, you know, they're not, you're getting dehydrated because they're vomiting and not keeping any fluids down and having fevers and just need to come in for some IV fluids. And that's really, you know, sort of Bobby alluded to the value of experience. And I think that's so much of what we do, especially in pediatrics, is just being able to look at a kid. And you know, we always tell trainees that your first job and the thing you have to be able to do is to walk into a room and say, sick or not sick. And not just sick, like, oh yeah, you do have a cold, you do have a boo-boo, but are you truly sick or are you not that sick? Probably gonna go home, maybe need some tests, maybe need some medications, maybe even need to be admitted to the hospital, but not truly sick in the way that, you know, makes me take notice and call in some help and not leave your bedside.
Right. So like a true emergency.
Yeah.
Versus maybe something a little urgent or
Yeah.
I've not heard the term worried well. Is that hypochondriac, or maybe you think you're having a serious medical issue, but it may not be as serious? That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's somewhat self-explanatory, I think, right?
Yeah.
Worried well often is, and it can be used in sort of a, you know, maybe a deprecating kind of sense, but yeah, worried well being like, you know, there's nothing all that wrong. You were sort of worried out of proportion to what was going on. But truthfully, it's not really, I don't regard it as my place to say you shouldn't have come in. It is exceptionally rare for me to say, like, well, this patient shouldn't have come into the ER. In the end, if you thought you needed to come into the ER, it's a good chance you were right. And, like, you know, I think you come out of residency thinking you know a whole lot, and then the longer you do this, the less you think you know, right? The more you learn. It's like the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? But you just sort of realize, like, patients will you know, take you down a notch every so often. You're like, oh, this guy's fine. And then you realize, like, oh, no, this guy's not fine. He was totally right. I was way wrong about this one. I use the term worried well and, you know, sort of just to give a sense of the spectrum. But I think it's rare that I would really say, like, this person shouldn't have come in.
Yeah, I like that. I think we're often worried well about our family members and friends. You know, you get so worried. They may not be as worried, but you're like, oh, I think you need to go in. I mean, but I like that if you think you need to go in, then that's a reason to go in.
Yeah.
People usually have an intuition.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, fortunately, there are sort of a lot of resources now to help you kind of figure out, like, well, you know, how worried should I be? There are nurse advice lines. There are on-call doctors for the majority, I would say, of primary care practices, especially in the pediatric world. But in the end, like, if people aren't able to get in touch with those resources or don't know how to reach out to them or just think it's too urgent, like, okay, sounds like we should be seeing you.
Thank you. And with that, it is time to take our first break. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion on the fast-paced and challenging aspects of emergency services and hospitalist care with Dr. Daniel Mindlin and Dr. Robert Finch as Line One continues statewide.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether this is your first try to quit or you've been down this path before, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help you quit for good. Get help creating a plan that is right for you, no matter if you smoke cigarettes, vape, use smokeless tobacco, or ICMIC. With options like calling a coach, receiving text messages, and nicotine replacement therapy with patches or gum, you can quit your way at any time of day or night. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by guest Dr. Daniel Mindlin, who is a board-certified emergency medicine physician and chair of emergency medicine at Providence Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage. Also joining us is Dr. Robert Finch, who is a board-certified family medicine physician and hospitalist who is also practicing at Providence Alaska Medical Center with the Alaska Hospitalist Group. We are discussing emergency and inpatient care in Alaska. Do you have questions about receiving inpatient care? Have you experienced emergency care? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So before the break, you were sharing some of the emergency situations that come in. And I had a question about whether people come in mostly on their own or via ambulance. What's the ratio like there?
I couldn't tell you numerically what the ratio is, but certainly, you know, the majority of the patients we see do come in through triage. They come in on their own or brought in by a friend or family member. And I think we're going to get into this a little bit, but, you know, that does not necessarily mean that they are not among the sick.
Okay.
You know, and likewise, patients who come in by ambulance may not be among the sick. And, you know, I think there's sometimes this phenomenon of people saying like, well, I'm going to come in by ambulance and I'll get seen right away. And that's unfortunately no longer the reality for a lot of reasons. But we do have ambulances that take their patients directly to the waiting room because, you know, the paramedics are highly trained and have evaluated the patient. And, you know, our nurses are highly trained and evaluate the patient. And there is a nurse out, you know, or multiple nurses out in triage. And sometimes, you know, we get a patient by ambulance. It's like, well, the patients that are walking in are sicker than you right now.
That's really good to know, because if you don't work in the emergency department, you only go on what you've seen on TV. And we talked about that a little bit. I don't think we mentioned the television show ER, though. But when you think about an ambulance bringing you into the hospital, you would probably assume that they roll you right in and everyone takes care of you right away. So that's new. That's new information.
Yeah, I think on ER, what happened usually was, and not having watched seasons of this show or anything,
of course not.
I watched a lot of that show in college. But yeah, the doctor meets the ambulance at the door and says, "Give me the bullet."
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you get the story while you walk to the room, and you might start three procedures on the way to the room. But yeah, and there certainly is an element of that with the patients that, you know, are coming in sick. And we do usually have a heads up. You know, we'll get sometimes a scene call on what we kind of jokingly refer to as the bat phone. There's this bright red phone that rings, and that's, you know, they'll tell us, well, there's this patient coming. Minimal details, because the patient is still on the scene. But often for, you know, patients that are going to require a lot of resources, that heads up, and that's a big part of like the system working well, for us to get that heads up and know that someone really sick is coming in. And, you know, we would always rather over respond than under respond. And in those scenarios, when I know that we're ready in the department and the patient's not there yet, I will walk out to the ambulance bay and wait for them there, so that when we get to the room, I've already heard a bit of the story from the paramedics and they're going to repeat it so that everyone in the room is on the same page and knows what's going on. But I can sort of, you know, share my attention a little more effectively and start evaluating the patient, at least visually, while they're being moved over to our gurney.
And who answers that phone?
Our charge nurse, the emergency department charge nurse, who has a job I don't envy.
Yeah, that would be tough. Are you doing procedures in the emergency department?
Yeah, that's one of the things I really enjoy about my specialty. I was not cut out to be a surgeon, among other things, as you might guess from my choice of specialty. Focusing on one thing for hours at a time is not really my strong suit. And I think, like, you know, the essence of a happy life in medicine is recognizing your strengths and weaknesses.
Absolutely.
But I do really enjoy doing things with my hands, and I enjoy solving problems. You know, I think a lot of what's gratifying about emergency medicine is having someone come in with a problem and sending them home without that problem. And so we do, a lot of, you know, laceration repairs of, you know, closing people's cuts and, you know, treating infections if people have an abscess, or draining, you know, pus from an abscess, which is not necessarily everyone's favorite procedure.
Not very glamorous.
Right. But satisfying, you know,
yes.
And certainly, you know, I mean, that really does dramatically help the patient. Mm-hmm. And then we also do a lot of the really critical procedures. We put in breathing tubes. We intubate patients regularly. We put in chest tubes if a patient has a collapsed lung, for example, from an injury of some kind, from chest trauma. We will actually make an incision in the chest wall and put in a tube to relieve the pressure on that lung, to allow their lung to expand again. There's a long list.
Yeah, those are very, like, exciting and dramatic procedures that have outcomes right away, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, exactly. And the real beauty of it for me is when you've done that procedure enough times that it just sort of flows, and you're like, okay, this comes next, everything is laid out, and it just goes smoothly. And I have a 4-year-old daughter, and she knows already that was sort of one of the mantras I've adopted, and I believe it's something that actually comes from the military. But if I say to her, slow is smooth, she says back to me, and smooth is fast.
Oh, I like that. Okay, slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yep, take your time, okay. Prepare, check your own pulse.
That's right. You have to be very calm in these emergency situations. Do you have there been points, I guess, where you felt that your heart is beating fast? Like, do you have those times where you're like, this is serious? And I guess, are there nerves?
Yeah, but only like 1 to 10 times a day. Yeah, absolutely.
Good to know.
Well, you know, we were joking earlier.
Keep a calm face.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to be the one making the patient more scared.
Right.
But yeah, you know, we were joking earlier about the feeling of being in a room and thinking I need an adult when you're right out of residency. And it gets better. But absolutely, you know, it's another of the old sort of, you know, the military borrowings that have made their way into emergency medicine is that it's long periods of boredom punctuated by sheer terror.
That's good. Yeah, that's true. Very true. Well, how do you work together? How do you, as an emergency medicine physician, and you as a hospitalist, collaborate?
With great gratitude.
Yeah. So usually, like I said before, when for whatever reason, the patient can't be discharged home, the ER docs almost always call the hospitalist at some point in that carousel of calling different doctors. And most of the time that if they're appropriate to be admitted, we'll admit them to the hospital, and then the specialist will be consults. And that would be, so we would dictate the care while they're there, coordinate the care with the different hospitalists and with the case managers and social workers and discharging. But basically that's how we interact. I mean, I think we, out of all the physicians in the hospital, I think the hospitalist and the ER docs are kind of the most joined at the hip. Because you know, they rely on us to get a good disposition for their patients that can't be admitted to the hospital or can't be discharged to home. And so we're pretty much a match made in heaven.
I like it. Now, are you doing any procedures on the floors?
No, not usually. In different hospitals, they probably are. Smaller hospitals where they don't have a lot of specialists. Where we're at Providence, there's, you know, usually an abundance of different physicians that can do that. For like drain placements and chest tubes and things like that, we would normally rely on our interventional radiology colleagues, because they're doing it under like CT guidance and ultrasound guidance, and it's probably a lot more accurate than doing it at bedside on the floor. I think the patients appreciate that a little bit more.
Maybe
just a little bit. We don't usually do a whole lot of procedures on the floor. I'll put the occasional rhino rocket in for like a nosebleed that's not stopping, things like that, but nothing as exciting as the ER physicians. So,
Well, this brings me to emergency department wait time. So you talked about, Dr. Finch, the disposition from the emergency department to you. What is the difference between emergency department wait times at different hospitals? Some hospitals boast that they have very short wait times. How does that happen? Why is the wait so long?
I can't necessarily speak to sort of the internal metrics in terms of how a hospital calculates the wait time that it might choose to advertise. But I mean, it's obvious to everyone that wait times have increased, wait times in particular for less acute patients have increased. It's a little tough because not every hospital is getting the same patients. There's some element of self-selection. You know, patients may choose to go to a hospital because their doctor has privileges there, or their doctor's clinic is there, or because they know, you know, they are a patient with chronic medical problems and they know that that's the hospital that has the services they need, or simply because that's the hospital that's closest to their home and it's where they feel comfortable and they know their family members will be able to visit them. So it's sort of a, you know, not all hospitals are created equal on a multitude of levels. But what has unfortunately ended up happening in recent years is that we just don't have beds in the hospital for all the patients. And this is true nationally. It's certainly severe in Alaska, and you know, I think our sort of relative remoteness complicates a lot of it. But there just isn't always somewhere for patients to go once we make the decision to admit them. You know, we say we're admitting them to the hospital, and then we have to say, but you're going to be in this room for a while. And you know, my mother-in-law was admitted to the hospital for about a week and spent over half her stay in the ER. Oh. And so, you know, it's certainly not exerting any special privilege there.
You couldn't help your mother-in-law
out?
Oh, nope. Man.
And I swear I would have if I had been able to. I like my mother-in-law.
Good.
But it really is a problem of, you know, we have what we refer to as boarding patients or boarders in the ER, and we'll sometimes have 20 patients in the ER. Now, we have 50-ish beds at peak capacity. And that's when we're not sort of taking over other spaces in the hospital, which we have to do sometimes. But if 20 of our beds are taken up with patients who we would traditionally have expected to be upstairs getting care from Dr. Finch and his colleagues, that severely limits what we can do. And we are trying to see patients wherever we can. I mean, we have a little room in our triage area, and we will pull patients in there if we think we can evaluate them safely and effectively in a chair. Then that's what we'll do. And there are, of course, a lot of limitations on what we can do there because they end up going back out to the waiting room after we see them. And it's not unheard of these days that we are calling the hospitalist and saying, hey, I'm sorry, I have a patient that needs to be admitted, and they're still in the waiting room.
Wow.
Yeah, I've had that happen.
Wow. So physically, there are just no beds in the emergency room because some of them are taken up by patients admitted to the hospital that don't have another bed in the hospital to go to.
Yeah.
And so then that's limiting your emergency bed. So Dr. Finch and colleagues, why why aren't we getting these patients into rooms in the hospital?
It's not for a lack of trying. So I think in the hospital, and I've worked at Matt too, I've worked at Alaska Regional, I've worked at Providence, and I've worked at St. Elias as well. I think the biggest problem with patient flow through the ER into the hospital and then ultimately home is the going home part. And there are, at least at Providence, there's about 11 services that we have, which means there's 11 different doctors every day that have a patient panel, 16, 18, sometimes 20, depending on how it gets. It even gets about low 20 sometimes. And they, at any given time, probably have a quarter of their list that are waiting for disposition to places that we don't have a bed for. They're sick enough where, or they have complicated enough diseases or can't care for themselves and don't have anybody here that precludes them from going home alone. But there is nowhere in the community to send them. You know, there's skilled nursing facilities, there's assisted living facilities, there's a long-term inpatient care center / inpatient rehab facility, St. Elias. But sometimes there's just nowhere to send these patients. And also, even if there is somewhere, sometimes it's a funding issue where we don't have any funding to pay for those services. And so we are getting them on Medicaid and then going, and then from Medicaid, we're getting them general relief funding, which is a fund from the state in order to pay for services like this. And that takes a long time, months. And so we have, there is definitely people in the hospital for 4 to 6 months, and they could have left at 2 weeks of their hospital stay. Type of situation. And so that bogs down everything. It's, you know, it's kind of the limiting factor, as it were, where we would love to have more people come out of the ER. We don't want them in the ER once they're admitted to the hospital. You know, the ER nurses are amazing, but they're not the same thing as a step-down nurse or an ICU nurse. And so there are things that each unit has that is specific for them, a neuro unit. They're used to dealing with people with strokes and different neurological problems where, you know, maybe the average ER nurse isn't. And that's fine. We all have our specialties, and we would like to get them out of the ER, but we just can't. It's not even really up to us. I remember during the Delta wave for COVID, we had admitted ICU people intubated in the PACU, the where people go after surgery to wake up and recover. And there was at least three or four intubated patients that should have been in the ICU, but there was no ICU beds. And there was no ICU beds pretty much anywhere in the state. It was pretty gnarly during that Delta wave. But that's kind of the situation that we live in. And it's not that people haven't tried to build more nursing homes and different things like that here. It runs into a bigger problem for Alaska and for a lot of places in the lower 48, and that's staffing. We just don't have the staff. So you can build a great, huge facility, but if you can't get, you know, nurses and aides and different people to work in these facilities because we don't have them, we can't send patients to an empty, empty room that's not staffed. So
you shared so much important information in that.
Sorry.
So much. I had so many, questions. First of all, it seems that you must have a team that you work with. So I would imagine social workers and things that could work on that funding piece mm-hmm. and the placement piece. When you talk about funding, I'm thinking that it must be very expensive to have a hospital stay for so long. It would be probably less expensive to have an outpatient facility. So, this seems like a systems problem.
It is. And there's not one,
one
fix
solution.
All. There's not one fix all that's going to just magically make it go away. But we do have a team of different personnel in the hospital that help us, that are great at their jobs. We have case managers and social workers and PT and OT and speech therapy. They all help us, get the patient better. So sometimes, like I said, we want to send them to a rehab facility. Well, we don't have funding or there's no beds. And so PT and OT still work with them in the hospital and try to get them better. And sometimes the delay to get them somewhere, we get them good enough to go home or find a family member that's willing to take care of them, things like that. So.
Right, because that may be important. You're not sick enough to be in the hospital, but you need a little assistance at home. And if you don't have someone there, that would be tough.
Yeah. Especially in Alaska, there's so many people that come up here and they don't have any family or friends it's kind of heartbreaking, but we see that all the time where they don't have anybody to take care of them. Or if they do, they're in Florida and it's not realistic to have them care for them.
And are there people that may be able to go home and they could go home alone, but they need to be closer to the hospital and so it wouldn't be practical for them to go out to maybe the village or something? Are there situations where you should be
definitely
close?
What comes to mind is like somebody that's post-operative. They need to follow up for, monitor their incisions and different things like that, but they don't have a place to go in town because they live in Bethel or Nome or one of the smaller villages. And so, they're kind of stuck with us for a little while until they get better. So,
yeah. Well, thank you both for sharing all of those things. That really opens our eyes to some of the challenges that you're facing and that we're facing as patients. We have to take one final break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on the ins and outs of emergency and hospitalist care when we return. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether this is your first try to quit or you've been down this path before, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help you quit for good. Get help creating a plan that is right for you, no matter if you smoke cigarettes, vape, use smokeless tobacco, or ICMIC. With options like calling a coach, receiving text messages, and nicotine replacement therapy with patches or gum, you can quit your way at any time of day or night. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Welcome back to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are Dr. Daniel Minlin and Dr. Robert Finch, both board-certified physicians at Providence Alaska Medical Center, providing emergency and inpatient care to Alaskans. You can also join our conversation. Do you have a question about what happens behind the scenes in the emergency department? Are you preparing for a hospitalization? Give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You were sharing with us, Dr. Mindlin, the issues with beds in the emergency department. So I had a question about urgent cares and whether that alleviates some of the issue if people go to the urgent cares, or does that compound the issue by sending more people that may need inpatient care? What do you think about urgent cares?
No, I think by and large it alleviates the issue. You know, there used to be, you know, we used to have the volume of sort of what we call basic care patients, sort of the less acute patients with your sort of more minor problems and you know, maybe a cut that needs to be sewn up, but nothing that was going to be terribly time consuming or severe. We used to have enough of those patients that we had a dedicated shift for 12 hours just seeing those patients. And really back in the day before my time, you might see 40 patients in that shift because you were just kind of banging it out and seeing them and discharging them, sort of the old treat them and street them. And that has changed. I mean, it's sort of the acuity has changed dramatically, particularly in the last few years. It's sort of, I think it's a heightening of a trend that's been going on for some time now. But we are absolutely seeing sicker patients and a higher proportion of patients needing to be admitted to the hospital, where it's routine now to admit, you know, a third of the patients that you see in a shift. That's not terribly unusual. So, you know, it's helpful to have less of that volume that might appropriately be going to urgent care, because now you've freed up a doc to see some of those patients that are, you know, more in need of truly emergent care. You know, I by and large, I think, you know, at least here, the patients that we see coming to the emergency department from urgent care are pretty appropriately referred. And if someone's going to be sitting in the waiting room, I would rather it be someone who is already seen by a provider. Mm-hmm. And we at least have some degree of assurance that they are, you know, they are not the truly undiagnosed critically ill. And so I know I think urgent cares play a pretty valuable role, sort of when used appropriately. We will always, till the day I am done in medicine and beyond, we will always see patients whose blood pressure is high and they are otherwise completely asymptomatic who are sent to the emergency department. And try as I might to trumpet the news that is not considered an emergency and hasn't been for a decade or so, I've yet to make much significant headway.
Well, I will tell you, when I see those high blood pressures, that is concerning. I am not send them to the ER, but I do call their primary care physician.
Which is a perfect thing to do.
Thank you. Okay. I do yes. do that.
Well, you know, I tell patients, you're in the ER now. I don't mind high blood pressures. I don't like low blood pressures. Mm. You get low enough, you get my attention. But you have to be, your head basically has to be flying off from the pressure before I really take notice of it.
Okay, that's good to know. Well, we all need to manage our blood pressure so we're not in that situation where somebody's deciding where you need to go.
Absolutely.
Blood pressure needs to be managed.
No, and that is absolutely true, right? I mean, the long-term consequences absolutely do bring people to me, the strokes and the heart attacks and that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is more the acutely high blood pressure. A patient with known high blood pressure whose systolic pressure might be 190 or 200. In the end, we're probably, unless they're having chest pain or having some other acute symptoms, we're probably going to say, well, you take a little more of your blood pressure medicine and you should go home and call your doctor.
Yes, absolutely. And maybe you can tell me about the trauma centers and the levels of the trauma centers.
Yeah, absolutely. So the American College of Surgeons designates levels of trauma care. There's sort of this very sort of well-regulated and formalized trauma system. And there are a lot of requirements that come along with that to really maintain the highest possible standards of care for patients with serious injuries. And so the level one is a trauma center that can offer sort of every conceivable service to the trauma patient. You know, there is an in-house neurosurgeon 24 hours a day. There are, you know, research programs and residents and, you know, there's sort of a bevy of requirements to be a level one. And I think realistically, it would be a different Alaska that could sustain a level one trauma center at this point. So sort of the next level where there is a surgeon in-house 24 hours a day, but some of those research requirements and others are not among the necessities, would be a level two trauma center. And we have two in Alaska and two here in Anchorage, which are Providence Alaska Medical Center and Alaska Native Medical Center. It's striking that the two trauma centers are, you know, across the street from each other. Yep. And then the rest of the the state, you know?
Right.
The idea of it being a trauma system is that it is truly an integrated system, that, you know, wherever you might make entry into this system, you are appropriately directed to the highest level of care that you need. And it is not unheard of that a patient who, you know, truly needs to be in Seattle goes directly to Seattle, bypasses Anchorage from certain parts of the state, or bypasses, you know, Juneau or wherever else. But, you know, typically, and I think it's more true, you know, every year that we can handle the vast majority of patients here in Anchorage. And I think I probably personally transfer one patient a year to Seattle, if that. Mm. The vast majority of patients do stay here and get care, if not close to home, at least closer to home, and, you know, where family can be with them and they can potentially, we can sort of ease that path to discharge that Dr. Finch was talking about.
Yeah, so important to be close to home and have that support. We have an email that's come in. It's pretty long, so we'll cover that first part, okay? All right, this is from Melanie. She says, as more and more of our healthcare systems are merging into very large systems, often for financial or funding reasons, it seems there is more competition for funding, paying patients, and disciplines that generate income. What are your thoughts on freestanding emergency departments that can be miles from actual hospitals? Many of these patients will need to have radiology tests and labs that are at the hospital. And of course, many may need imminent operating room services or need to be admitted to the hospital. So in freestanding emergency rooms.
I will fully disclose my bias in this matter, which is that I just think freestanding ERs are a bad idea. There is quite a bit of research showing that they increase costs. If you look in the lower 48 and, you know, sort of Texas in particular is known to be a hotbed of this, but, they tend to be situated in areas where a high proportion of patients have private insurance. They tend to be in or adjacent to affluent areas. And they do offer this sort of superficial sheen of convenience. Well, you're getting the same care, but it's closer to your house and you're not waiting as long. Well, the problem is if you're going to the ER, there's the idea that you might be sick. And if a truly sick patient, in that sense we were talking about before, comes to a freestanding ER, they are looking at being transferred to a hospital. They are looking at leaving the ER, getting in an ambulance, and being driven to a hospital, and then going through a whole intake process again. And, you know, however much you try to integrate that, you're not going to be taken care of by the same people. And we know that transitions in care are a major factor in medical errors. And medical errors are a fact of life, and it's all of our responsibility to diminish them. And so anything that increases the number of handoffs is potentially a detriment to the patient's care. I think, you know, ultimately they're good for finances. I don't think they're good for patients. I won't obscure the fact that there's currently a proposal to build a freestanding ER in Anchorage. There was a similar proposal to build two back in 2015 that the state denied. It ended up with our emergency department building more beds. But I would say that, you know, our problem really is not a lack of ER beds. Our problem is exactly that problem that Dr. Finch was talking about. You know, it's sort of, you know, as we refer to it, the whole hospital's constipated. And there's got to be a way out of the hospital. We also have inpatient beds in Anchorage that are not used for lack of staffing.
So they'll have that same situation in a freestanding emergency room.
Yeah. Yeah. If patients have nowhere to go, they have nowhere to go. And what's going to happen is, okay, do you want to wait in your bed in a freestanding ER? Or do you want to wait in your bed in the hospital in the ER? But I do think that as long as, you know, the state has a formula by which it calculates the number of beds that can be built. And unfortunately, that formula doesn't account for the unstaffed beds that we currently have. There are inpatient beds that don't have nurses for them. Not at Prov. Prov is fully staffed, but there are beds that we're not using right now. And I think if it were me, I would love to sort of focus the attention on getting those beds staffed before considering building a whole new facility.
That's great. That's great information and advice. We have another email that came in wanting to know whether emergency department physicians are all independent contractors.
At Providence, yes. So my actual group is Alaska Emergency Medicine Associates. We are independent contractors. We've held this contract for a for quite some time, for decades. It's really, I mean, but this is the only hospital we work at. And we really are dedicated to where we work and really a part of the life of the hospital. And that's true at Alaska Regional Hospital as well. There's another group that is contracted there. At ANMC, no, those are employed physicians. Nationally, the trend has been toward physician staffing groups, what are called contract management groups, taking over a lot of ERs and unfortunately sort of forcing out the independent democratic groups like ours that are really sort of a part of that community. And, you know, those groups can come in and, you know, like any sort of large corporation, these are private equity backed for the most part, and they can say, well, we're going to offer you the same thing for less, you know, we'll give you a better deal. And that often happens by sort of, you know, saying, well, you can have your old job, but you're going to work a lot more and under less favorable terms. And you can take it or leave it because we also hold the contract in every other ER in your area. So unless you want to move, you're going to work with us. Mm. And, you know, again, I sort of recognize my bias here as sort of a, you know, member of an independent democratic group. But like, I live in this community and I want what's best for our community. You know, I make my sort of hospital level decisions as chair and my patient care level decisions on the basis of like, you know, this could be my family in the ER. And no corporation is ever going to be able to say that.
That's true. They also want to know about the relationship to the Providence Charity Care Program as far as the emergency medicine physicians and the hospitalist physicians. Do you have any relationship with that program?
Yeah, basically, when we care for a patient in the emergency department, there's sort of, and I, truthfully, I will admit that the intricacies of the billing often are sort of a little beyond me because that's not how I approach the patient encounter, right? I mean, one of the beautiful things about my job and Bobby's job is we take care of people no matter what. If they need it, they get it. And, you know, that does have consequences down the line. You know, that care ultimately has to get paid for in the system that we have. And I do think, you know, I appreciate working in a system that is really dedicated to taking care of patients and not maximizing profits first. And so Providence does provide a ton of charity care. And, you know, it's sort of one of the little known facts about hospitals is that they have this charge master, right? And that's now publicly available by federal law, right? But there is a list of sort of what everything in the hospital costs, but that doesn't mean that's necessarily what has to get paid, right? So no one's ever told they can negotiate with the hospital, but it is actually true.
Okay.
That someone says, I can't pay this, and, you know, yeah. But Prov is really, I mean, Prov has a whole office dedicated to, like, figuring out, you know, how to make care available to patients and really make sure that it doesn't break the bank because medical debt is such a huge issue.
Absolutely. We've run out of time. I just want to give maybe Dr. Finch a moment to share his final thoughts. I'm sure you have something.
My final thoughts, I guess, would be that I feel the ER and the hospitals are intricately connected, mm-hmm. and we strive to take the best care of patients and help people in the community as best we can. You know, I think the biggest problem that we have right now is not having enough places to send people.
Yeah.
And I think if we can alleviate that, maybe instead of a freestanding ER, that would get better flow through our ERs and through our hospitals and make patient care better.
Yeah, focus the attention elsewhere. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Robert Finch and Dr. Daniel Mindlin, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.